Welcome to the monthly wrap-up of the Talent Savvy podcast. My name is Bas van der Hatert and I'm joined by Matthias and Oana, as always. So, August has been a slow month in some things, which is very usual for having a summer month, but it has always also been a month of extreme weather. From lots of rain in the Netherlands, from now code reds in the south of Germany, Austria, and the north of Italy, hailstorms destroying cars in northern Italy, floods actually killing people in Slovenia, and not talking too much about the weather itself, but about the labor market impact. This weekend, there was an amazing article in Recruiting Brain Food, Hung Lee's newsletter, about what future of work do we have in a warmer world. And this woman amazingly writes that we broke every record. History has always told us that in the south of Europe, where, among others, Oana, you now live, siestas has been big, where the Germans, Matthias, have always been saying that's just for lazy-ass people. And now, apparently, the Germans are saying we might need to have a siesta in our labor law because it's getting too warm in Germany as well. What do you guys think will the impact of the weather be on the future of work? And Oana, you have lived in so many different places with different climates. Now you just are finishing your first official Spanish summer. How have you experienced it and what do you think?
Well, it's not for everybody, I must say. Okay, so I am still in Barcelona based. Hello, everybody, which is quite different than, let's say, Extremadura or some central areas of Spain. I think it's very important to realize just that the pattern of movement, the pattern of working and living is different. I've realized this firsthand. I'm looking at my steps count. And in general, if you do the same, you would see this bell curve, right? You wake up, you start kind of walking around, doing your things. You do more and more towards middle of the day, end of the day, and then shut down. Mine looks like a camel back, right? Like you do a lot of stuff early in the morning, 6 a.m., 7, 8, 9, 10, shut down, put the shutters in, stay inside wherever you can with aircon if you have, lucky you. And then you carry on with a lot of like hours, 4 or 5 hours till midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m. because the rest is too hot. This has been a reality, right? It's nothing new per se, but I think we have a lot to learn. So I'll maybe let Matthias, because I think things have changed also in Germany in the past years, and we might see some patterns of living and working. I think they're very, very connected when it comes to weather.
Yeah, I mean, look, hello, everyone. First of all, what I have seen is especially the aircon that you mentioned, right? I think some offices still don't have them. Some do. Some people at home, most of them are still, you know, big fans of hybrid approaches or home office. And then not everyone has a cool or aircon flat. Yeah, I think many don't. Depends a little bit how old your house is, but it can get very hot at home pretty fast. And that's then something to consider if people then make the move to the office or not. But I think normally for the type of work that we do, for the tech startups and so on, I think we have cool places, we have nice aircon places in the office at least, which might be a reason for people to come back. Yeah, you never know. I think what we have seen in Berlin is that, yes, at some point, I'm in the office at the minute where there's no aircon. And at one point, it's a nice corner office, 18th floor, super nice and barely in Mitte. So you have an amazing view, but it gets really, really hot. And so at one point you'd be like, "Pooh, can't take this. Yeah, it's impossible. I need to go. I need to stay at home because there it's a little bit more quiet." But like going back to what it affects probably your way of working, right? Just when I said the way you work, the way you think about when am I in flow, when not, when I have a lot of meetings. So you need to adjust to your environment there. And that's maybe where the time is where some people might not be able to do this that quickly or not. So that's something to consider, I would say, my two cents.
Yeah, and I'm actually, one of the things I've been thinking about with these weather, changing weather patterns is that for some jobs will become so much more scarce because they're weather dependent. Think about a house painter. I just had my house painted, incidentally, but they can only work when it's not raining, because in the rain you can't really, at least if it's a drizzle, it's okay, but if it's really raining, you can't paint the outside of a house because the paint will immediately go off. If it's not too hot, because apparently over 25 degrees, the paint won't stick well, etc., etc. So for these people, the number of days they can actually do the outside of a painting will dramatically decrease, or maybe not if the winters become warmer and it's not too cold. But and so there are a couple of jobs which I'm like, will we get a massive problem with not the number of laborers, but the number of days that those laborers can actually work? And I'm pretty sure there will be other jobs as well, which will be massively affected by these weather patterns.
But wouldn't you argue that technology maybe solved this at one point? That,
maybe.
yeah, that you have somehow like cooling systems on your jackets or something like that. Or, I mean, I don't want to be back in the future kind of guy, yeah, but I still remember those jackets, and you can adjust this. And this might be an opportunity, yeah, if that really becomes reality.
And just to add here, diversity will help, because people up north have been doing this for hundreds of years. People in the global south have been living with this for millennia, right? So I think what we see now, it's a bit of an Eurocentric approach. Oh my God, we discovered heat. Sorry, I'm a bit crossed with this take.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Right. I think I appreciate the conversation. I think it's important to ride the wave. There is a lot of conversation in any news outlet out there, in any newspaper. There is everything about green energy, resource management, global kind of distribution of labor comparing to the climate changes. But ultimately, this is not new, and we can learn so much from each other if we can listen, right? And I hope we can see that change will happen for sure.
Yeah, and I think the fact that actually Germans are now saying the siesta isn't a matter of being lazy is actually a sign that we are learning from different cultures.
I think on behalf of all my Spanish friends who are like, this is a myth. We don't go to sleep during the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's dive into the topics. Oana, you brought a great article on leadership. Do you want to share what it's about?
Yes, for sure. So I am always interested somehow in understanding at a macro level, how do we end up in talent acquisition, right? Like, how do people end up there and how do they grow? Because it seems still such a big mystery for most people. And recently, actually, the guys from LinkedIn Insights, some content managers there, they've put together a small report. I wish it would have been richer, to be honest. I'm just going to put this little asterisk there. There's probably so much more data that we can tap into and learn from, but it is still a very good kind of overview of what's happening global level. When I say global level, the kind of survey they did, or the data collection they did, taps into about 500,000 talent leaders. And here they mention it's Director Plus, which is an impressive number, over 10 years, 2013 to 2023. And then about 100,000 L&D leaders. And they kind of make a little mapping, heat map there, based on three criteria. Criteria number one, they admit methodology is not great, but it is a gender binary approach. They make a little star as well. Hey, sorry about this. We kind of have to report it like this in order to report it confidently, but we are aware much more people would actually not go into the binary metric dimension. But ultimately, not a very big surprise there. From that approach, they actually are showing us nothing very surprising, that about 65 or 68% of the talent acquisition leaders, are women. At the global level, I think this is relevant. I think we would see very interesting pockets if we look country by country, which I would hope we will get that published at some point by LinkedIn Insights. The second approach, the second dimension they look at is, where were these people right before they got into that TA or L&D Director Plus function? And first of all, I misread the article, to be honest, first three times, I think. And I was quite like surprised, because it says they come from HR mostly versus other functions like sales, operations, business development. And then I was like, yeah, but what do you mean talent acquisition leaders come from HR? I've rarely seen that actually. They come mostly from talent acquisition. But then I took a look at their actual, the way they write it makes you wonder that, but the way it's shown visually, you actually realize, which is fair, that TA is incorporated in HR. There is no like TA versus HR, because I come from this background where TA is not HR. Please do not put me in the same bucket. Yeah. That changed throughout the years. I am now very proudly part of the HR/people/whatever you want to call it function. We are all in the same bucket, no problem at all. But in my youth, I was like, no way. So this is interesting because with L&D director plus levels, it's actually very different. They mostly come from non-HR functions. They come from education. They come from business development. They come from operations, which kind of tells us if you want to be a leader in the L&D space versus some others, the jungle gym, they call it. Like there is maybe a more weird path that you might see. The opportunity is there. I'm not sure why. I would love to see some insights. Maybe you can share your opinion. Why is it maybe less linear for L&D people, this career path versus some other functions? And then the third dimension was, which was it? Tenure, years of experience, right? Again, maybe not very surprising. If you look at Director Plus, the big buckets would be about 20%, 15 to 20 years, and then another 20%, 20 years plus, especially at C-level, if you're really, really high, or VP level. So at least in general, I think if you are looking, hey, I want to be at this level, I should give it about 10 years. This is kind of what my conclusion is from this research. Around like 10 years, you could be eligible if I call it so. But I think the variety with 15, 20 years, it's quite interesting there. Where did you find maybe any surprises for you? Because, yeah, I think it's fairly straightforward, but...
Yeah, I think about the point that most TA leaders are hired externally.
Yeah.
So the question is here, are we unable to build future TA leaders internally? I don't know. My experience shows clearly that I've always been hired externally in such roles because they didn't have this, there was a clear skill gap. And that's why they did this. But also some people failed or the current setup didn't work as well. And there was the time where people then suggested, hey, let's go, Matthias, can you help us here? And then when you have the conversation around how to help them, then you clearly see that they don't have the right view of what it means to be a talent TA leader or to have a strong TA function. And then this is where change management comes in. But to get back to this topic, it's interesting, right? So people are hiring in most cases externally because they haven't succeeded with what they have been doing in the past and they needed new ideas, new approaches, and then do this. So that's something that I found very interesting.
Can I throw another hypothesis in there?
Mm-hmm.
Because, Matthias, I remember, if I'm not mistaken, your career, you also moved from a senior TA position to a TA leader position at another company. You were also an external hire when the first time you became a leader. Now, my hypothesis is because, and both of you have been working in Søren Winter's team, that great TA leaders produce great TA leaders.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason you needed to go somewhere else is because you weren't going to replace the great guy above you, but you've learned so much from being a great TA leader. And it might actually be that they can't grow them internally because they don't really have an amazing TA leader. So you go to the places where they got the right coaching from a great person. Now in Germany, that's Søren Winter. Here in the Netherlands, we have a woman called Monique Buur, whose entire team at A.S. Watson, big company in the retail industry, and her entire team became amazing TA leaders at other companies at some point because they had the right coach above them, helping them understand what is important and seeing actually a team excel. So my hypothesis is that most of them come from external resources because they don't see anybody in the team because the TA leader that was there before wasn't capable enough to actually create anybody in that team.
Yeah, I kind of like that hypothesis. I think it makes sense in a lot of environments. I would also add that the report really pulls on the hypergrowth period, especially in tech, right? So there was so much demand that, you know, I'm not saying we took everybody or anybody. I'm just saying it is a very, very specific timestamp on this.
Yeah, but they were looking for a lot of director levels. And yeah, if I look at those, also the age cohorts they have, I'm actually thinking, because it wasn't mainly the scale-up companies they have been looking at. They looked at their entire database. And eventually, there are still a lot more director-level people at corporates as well.
Yes, for sure.
But what I've been seeing, and this is actually surprising to your point, Ioana, that L&D leaders... Or actually, I have a hypothesis why they hire external L&D leaders as well. But this is going to be a really risky one, to be honest. Please, people, don't burn me. But what I've seen those few times I was actually embedded in an HR team and not just a TA team, the L&D department did not have the most ambitious people in there. They had excellent experts who love building great learning programs and making sure that they were very accessible, etc. At least the ones I've been with, but they had nobody, at least those few times I was in there, with the ambition to be a manager, to be a leader, to grow above the team. They had experts in there who knew they were experts, and probably because they did a few L&D courses on management, knew it wasn't for them. That's why they might be taking out external people to put above them, because the teams themselves don't have the ambition to be a manager because they just love building the programs itself. That's a hypothesis I have there.
Yeah, well, I guess everything will change if we have a skill-based approach.
Yeah, 100%. We hired our L&D leader also externally from a company that is actually advising bigger corporates to run their L&D trainings, their leadership trainings, etc. So that person did nothing else than just going to those big corporates and do those trainings with those very experienced leaders. At the end of the day, I agree. I think from a startup environment, we see most of the time that there are not such things like L&D functions, especially in smaller teams. It's more a general team or generalistic teams. And then if you go into the likes of Zalando, Wayfair or the bigger companies, they then start building this up. I think it's always this challenge, like, do you have that skill set already in your company? And then this person can grow the company over time, or you need to develop people. But most of the time, the companies move faster than the people can develop. And of course, then it makes sense to get to close the skill gaps externally. Yeah.
Well, we've mentioned skill gaps a few times. Ioana, you also brought an amazing article on skills and TikTok's investment in that.
Well, I found it very interesting. So TikTok decided to partner with an organization called Rethink Ireland, if I'm not mistaken, and created a fund of about 1 million euro to invest in youth upskilling, youth unemployment, access to work, kind of covering a digital gap, let's say, so that Ireland has uncovered. There were two things, the good side and the bad side. I see a dark side in most things, unfortunately. But I would say we don't see this type of initiatives as much as I would like to. So corporate organizations realizing their skill gaps and their needs somehow in the future, not this month or this year, but 5 years, 10 years from now on, and correlating that with actual realities in some markets. I think what TikTok here is doing is really smart for their development in Ireland. They are putting themselves on the map as the nice guys, which I'm not really sure I fully buy into, but that's another discussion. The investment is super interesting, on the other hand, because they actually partner with Rethink Ireland, but Rethink Ireland has a competition, which actually, we're going to link this, but it's still open until, I think, 24th of September. And if you are an NGO in Ireland, you can apply for a grant of about 100K, 200K. I think they're going to split it in a couple of areas. And if your project actually serves this let's say, digital gap covering and upskilling of youth. It's between 15 and 24 years kind of focus programs. But it's giving work to give work to give work in a way. In my taste, maybe there are too many middle mm-hmm. persons. But it is very interesting that ultimately the grants are allocated to NGOs, people who are on the ground, people who probably have this type of initiatives and plans and skills, but they didn't have the budget to amplify them. And I'm very, very curious what will come out of this. I have not seen much in Germany or in the Netherlands. I would be very curious to hear more of this type of initiatives where we have corporate and, let's say, NGO collaborations in such a scale manner.
Well, I was actually also surprised, as you were, that Tech Talk was allowed in, because right now the Dutch government is actually saying you cannot have Tech Talk on your work phone anymore for public.
What?
Because they are very much afraid of espionage-like actions. So government officials are not allowed to have TikTok on their work phone. Which, by the way, the biggest problem here is with the police, because the police uses a lot of TikTok to get news facts out. So now they were like, well, so the most vulnerable public phones, we're going to make an exception for that. Something in my head was like, well, maybe we need to buy yet other phones if you're so afraid of that, please don't let the police use it. But the police is like, we can't do without TikTok anymore because then we can't inform the younger public, which is a completely different story. But let's not go into the entire TikTok mess. What I was most surprised about, actually, was they were saying we're going to help the youth with their digital skills. Now, the one thing I don't understand is, why do you need to help the youth with their digital skills in the most digital platform there is? Is that not? I don't get it. What digital skills are you going to help the youth with on if they're already on TikTok making videos probably themselves? That was mind blowing to me.
Well, this is interesting, right? Because I was now in Romania on holiday. I have some cousins, nieces, whatever, the 14, 16, 17 years old. COVID has really messed up a lot of stuff when it comes to their education during the pandemic. The learning opportunities somehow diluted. This was the signal I got there. We must not forget that the urban population, it is very digital savvy. The wealthy population, it is very digital savvy. But the rural and maybe not so enabled financially is not. And I think we must separate somehow. I mean, this is why I'm curious which projects will win. Because if the project is, oh, we're going to work with the top universities in Dublin and blah, 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 not cool. But if you're going to Connemara and you're targeting people who are living in remote villages and you try to understand what types of skills they need to develop to be competitive in the labor market afterwards, I think that would be very interesting. Minorities, immigrants, a lot of like categories go in there. I see what you're saying, Bas, and I approve to a certain extent, but we do have some blinkers when it comes to this.
Yeah, but I wonder now, and you know Ireland because you've lived there and I've never been there a lot better, if this is different for Ireland. But if I look at the Netherlands and I think most of Germany, I mean, even in the rural areas, if I look at France, even in the most rural areas, if there's internet everywhere, not as high quality, but they can do anything anyway. I know that actually in Italy, it's a bit different because the rural areas are not that well connected with the internet. That's actually why the EU is giving them a few billion to fix that problem now, I think. But there's a massive gap if you look at, of course, Romania, which has always been higher on the Gini coefficient, so to say. So the wealthy and the underprivileged are much further apart. If I look at actually all the people who came in from Syria or Ukraine to the Netherlands in recent years, they're very digital savvy because that's the way they actually managed to escape and get here. The thing, actually, one of the main complaints from the Syrian refugees is that our Dutch immigration system doesn't work well on their mobile phones and they need a laptop for that. I mean, our government systems are not digital savvy enough for the immigrants, not the other way around.
Maybe TikTok should redirect their funding.
But was it TikTok funding this, or was it the Irish capital funding TikTok?
No. Is TikTok granting the 1 million, to be precise, 750K is in awarding this, let's say, winners of the competition, and 250K to enable advertising for the programs. And the categories are like digital literacy, communication skills, learning and development, and creativity.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that TikTok is spending this kind of money on Ireland. I immediately wonder what's the political game behind it. Matthias, any last thoughts on the TikTok subject?
No, I think it's good to do it. I think I would love to see more companies doing it, investing in skills. Yeah, even if it's like underprivileged but I don't think we don't see this, because the Germans still probably have a struggle with skill-based hiring. Yeah, so that's maybe the topic. So the awareness needs to go higher before we make actually do this. But I like it.
Yeah, well, moving on to skill-based hiring, the article I put into our discussion is that the parent company of Coors and Miller has for a few positions, in Western Europe, EMEA, had a CV-free job posting. So you had an application, they had a measurement of potential using the assessments from Arctic Shores, then an interview, and then a decision on the feedback, but nowhere in there was a CV check anymore. It was just for a few positions, but they really went to a skill-based hiring. Now, I've seen this in a few places here in the Netherlands, because of course I'm massively involved in everything which has to do with skills and assessments. I know a few organizations who've done this, but not that many, and especially not big corporates. And if they did it, it was only for graduate positions. But this was actually, among others, for a very senior role, if I'm not mistaken, the brand development manager for sales. And they said, you don't need any experience. You just need to have the right skills. So I was positively surprised that a massive company like this is taking on a genuine skills-based hiring approach. What are your thoughts, Matthias?
I love it. I looked at a report today, or posted this, where we can see that recruiters now switching from sourcing to application reviews because they are flooded with applications. So now think about this, right? If we change this game and actually don't look at applications so much, I mean, then somebody commented on this post and said, yeah, but we can help, recruiters in the application review stages. Yeah, maybe with tech people or so ever to be faster. But then again, it's not so much about the amount of application, but the decision-making process that you apply, right? And I'm totally with you. You probably all know this, that the resume is the most biased document that we have in our hiring process. And so many people seem to not know this, right? So I really love the approach. Also did a skill-based hiring organization training on LinkedIn, and they said this exactly same thing, right? They say, look, you need to put in some analysis, some tasks beforehand, and then really filter this out, and then you will get the best of the best. Yeah, and so many times we are driven by interviews that are also very much subjective and biased. So yeah, I think it's a good thing.
I didn't understand if the system actually eliminates or passes through automatically, or the assessment that the applicant needs to do is reviewed by a human. I didn't fully see if there is a benchmark line, like with, I don't know, tech tests, right? You have HackerRank and you're like, you're 80%, then you go forward. This was not very clear for me.
No, and probably because they didn't announce this. They didn't interview, they just looked at it. What I know, because I actually know Arctic Shores quite well, they are literally the company why I started being interested in assessments, which is not saying that they're the best in all circumstances, but the team behind it is really science-driven and I really like them. I know their system doesn't have, by definition, cutoffs. So I actually once bought them for one of my clients, and we had to negotiate with them that we could get like a percentage match. But then we had this really big analysis on the back end where we had everybody who was already doing the job, which were a lot of people doing the analysis, having graded, like we put everybody in that job in three buckets, amazing, acceptable, we shouldn't have hired this person. And we had an algorithm look at what are then the actual traits that matter a lot, and can we have percentages? Because, for example, one of the traits we were then looking at was grit. But there is such a thing as too much grit, because that means you never ship, you know? That's over-perfectionism. So we actually were measuring, like, where did it end up? I am assuming, because Arctic Shores measures a lot of different traits, that they basically build a profile, like somebody needs this, and they had some sort of a matching algorithm. But I'm very confident that it's probably a recruiter looking at the scores and saying, okay, this person has a little more of this, a little less, et cetera, et cetera. And it's still a manual application. But it could very well be that the people who don't score at all on certain traits, you go pretty quickly to auto reject those. That's my, but this is all assumptions.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And then I was reading a bit more through the article that they are piloting this with this one role, but they still have like 200 open, which still focus on the CV phase first. So I think it's going to be a long process for us to understand what's the best, what problem are we solving for, first of all, because if you're just swapping the stages, right, you do the assessment and then based on the results of the assessment, I check your CV and then I pass you forward. I don't think we've solved enough. So, yeah.
But in this case, they were not doing this. I've actually seen this at two companies, actually two local governments, separate of each other, also both using different tools. The one was the city of Rotterdam, where they did it for a recruiter. And the reason they only did it for a recruiter was because the head of recruitment really wanted to test this, but couldn't get a hiring manager to sign off on it. And then he was like, wait a moment, I'm a hiring manager. Let's do this for my own job. And because that recruiter was so extremely successful and all of his hiring managers were like, well, you're the best guy I've ever had. And he said, well, I wouldn't have ever come here if not for this test. All of a sudden, these hiring managers were like, could this test work for me? So they used the oil spill, you know, very just infecting other people. And they did it really nice with they asked both for a resume and a test, and they had one group looking at the resumes and deciding who they wanted to interview, and one group looking at the test, and they really showed the value of the test. So, yes, it's only one job, but at least they're experimenting with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was no CV in there anymore. So I was very positively surprised that they were going into this direction. I recently actually got a message on LinkedIn from somebody asking me, do you know any companies who are really doing skill-based hiring? To which I had to reply, well, the honest truth is only for graduate positions. I know several who say, we don't care about what you graduated at. We don't even actually care about the fact that you graduated. Here's a test. And if you excel at this test, it's a traineeship anyway. So if you have the potential to learn the skills, we'll teach you. I know several of those, but very limited on skills-based hiring. And very often, if companies are now going to skills-based hiring, I see them going to CVs, extracting skills, and then, but that's not really skills-based hiring as far as I'm concerned.
Agreed.
No. So then let's jump into the very last insight, which is actually linking to skills-based hiring. I read an article, and we are going to into the financial part now, that Main Capital has actually sold Assessio to another investment group called Pollen Street Capital. Now, for those of you who don't know, Assessio is from origin, I think, Swedish, and they were bought by Main Capital a couple of years ago. They bought a few other really big, among other Dutch companies called ALO and HFM Talent Index. They made a big assessment group out of it. So I was really surprised to hear that they were exiting the assessment space now that skills-based hiring, where Assessio should be very good at, is really getting traction, especially since Main Capital is also the main owner of TextKernel, which I always saw them merge because TextKernel is approaching skills-based hiring for more the resume, and they have this entire beautiful ontology of skills, related skills, etc., etc. And Assessio is actually able to test stuff. I was really surprised by this move. What are your thoughts?
What do I think about it? I think, so, look, when what Bas describes is if you would have seen two of those tools merging and they didn't, what would be the reason, right? And as another fact that you said is like they sold it to another investor. So for me, that seems like if I know this, they were maybe short of money, they needed to sell, there was maybe pressure on this. They could not merge to one roadmap that actually made sense, even if it would make sense from the outside. Maybe there was a clash there. And the other investor wanted to build something as well, but they couldn't have the tech or the talents. And that's why they bought them. So all of these opportunities could have been the place or the case here. I don't know too much to say, look, this makes sense or not.
Do you see any particular danger, Bas? Like, you were expecting maybe more maturity, more strength. Do you have any concerns? Because if we see more of these movements of divide and conquer and sell more pieces versus maybe in a way from the competitivity point of view, it's good, but maybe from the maturity point of view, it's not so good. I'm not sure.
Well, there's so many new startups in this part of the industry in recent time. And we know a lot of them will go out of business. And I'm expecting a few of them to actually fall out of business in the next year or two, simply because they run out of funding and their product is mediocre at best. I see a big risk, which is actually something Arctic Shores had been telling me about, of tests that, among others, Assessio is very big on, being so manipulable by ChatGPT, because you can just ask ChatGPT, how do I answer this to come to this specific culture? You know, read the culture from this website and tell me how to answer this type of test. And they will bring up most of the answers pretty well. So there's a big risk now from generative AI to the traditional question-based assessments.
Mm-hmm.
That's why, and actually I have been wondering when Assessio was going to buy a game-based assessment like Arctic Shores, which they actually already have very big deals with, because Assessio is the reseller for Arctic Shores in the Benelux. So I actually had been expecting around this time for them to announce, we're going to be buying Arctic Shores. Now I know why they didn't, because they were selling the entire company. I do expect them to goggle up a few more big players.
Mm-hmm.
And right now in this industry, a lot of pieces are moving. There's a great opportunity for players like, well, now the new owner, Pollen Capital. I was surprised that Main Capital was exiting. So I think, Matthias, you might be right that the investors want their money back or something. They built this big company. It was a mediocre small company from the Nordics. It's now pretty big in a lot more of Europe. And it's time for the next step. I'm just surprised they aren't taking that next step.
Hmm.
Can I just say that Arctic Shore should sponsor this episode? I think we've mentioned them like 16 times. It was by accident, but they should come front.
I will let them know that they owe us at least a beer the next time we're at RecFest.
Yes.
I'm sure they will. So moving on to then the very last topic, because Matthias, you also threw in a big, big report on the startups within Europe. Do you care to elaborate on the report?
Yes. So this is a massive report. We are talking 102 pages here. And when I saw it again, I was like, oh my God, yeah. How do you sum it up within like 2 minutes? So let's get started. So since 2016, the Startup Heatmap Europe survey, it's probably the longest running analysis of founders' sentiments in Europe. And every year, the researchers behind Startup Heatmap, try to give another refreshing look on the development of the European startup scene. So that's for us, for our podcast, our idea of our episode today, amazing, right? So what are they looking at? Just to give you a little bit of an idea, if you don't want to read the whole thing, they have three different parts. They have Europe's most popular startup cities, which is nice to look at, right? Where are we and did we gain or lose in that environment? And they have a complete list of the top 50. Then they have the second part, which is trends in Europe and the European ecosystem. And then they have the third part, which is an open startup ecosystem and sustainable growth. So quite interesting. And I pick out a couple. So what is interesting, if you took a look at the most popular startup hubs, London gained the first place again. Unfortunately, my Berlin friends and the Berlin citizens need to be second place this time. Barcelona stayed third, which is great, right? So kudos, Oana, right? Second, third. Amsterdam is fourth, so Bas, yeah, it's not so far. And then we have Paris, Lisbon, Munich, Tallinn, Stockholm, and Zurich. When you go a little bit more down, I think what is really, really interesting and what excited me actually, I'm not going to the top 50 here, but it's like 71% of the European founders are optimistic about what's coming next. And I'm like, okay, that's actually good, right?
Yeah.
So then I checked it out and I saw, oh no, it was actually dropping, right? So last year in 2021, we had 75. In 2022, they had 71. So this is the overall score. And then when you look a little bit more closer into like who is the most optimistic, actually makes sense. Western Europe, yeah, is there with 79%. And then we have the Nordics and the Baltics with 78, so not so much off. And then what is very, very interesting is that the Mediterranean are with 62, not so optimistic. And it's interesting because I've seen recently in recruitment and economics or recruitonomics call that saying, or an article that's saying, look, the southern European states will outperform the northern because of tourism and everything else. So it was a huge huge article, so maybe something to look at. But I don't want to go hijack the report. Maybe also something that is interesting, they say 66% of the founders, the European founders, if they would have the choice again where to found their business, they would prefer Europe over the US. So that's interesting. I feel like especially the Germans, we kind of are very much, I wouldn't say in love with our country, but let's say we have a lot to complain always. Yeah, something's not working well, the government, everything is not so good, right? But seems like Europe is doing quite okay, yeah? But maybe one more last step, which I thought was super interesting. It goes really deep, but startups' contributions to job growth, yeah? So startups' contribution to job growth, what we can see here is that it actually went down a bit, right? It makes totally sense because we have a lot of layoffs and that were happening. And then when you look at the importance of venture capital for society, they looked at venture capital as a share of private equity in Europe. And they just said, look, 14% of those venture capital is private equity, which is scored the highest in 2021, 14.5, and now it went down to 10.9. There are some really interesting stuff. I really would recommend everybody looking into this because I think it's so huge that you sometimes get easily lost. But for people, what is the takeaway for our audience here is for people who really want a deep dive of where am I located in Europe? Mm-hmm. What is my market compared to other markets? That's interesting. It also depends a little bit. They had a nice view about exit markets, which are the best exit markets. So in whatever state you are in, series A, B, C, or D, yeah, it gives you a little bit of an idea of what is likely to happen and what not, right? That's super, super interesting. And this is a great opportunity to showcase that to the business. I already shared it with my CEO today and said, look, you need to look at this. This is interesting. It will definitely give you a little bit more market intelligence and business maturity understanding.
I loved it. I love the report. And I think it's really, really timely and useful because I imagine everybody's preparing for 2024. Where do I want to like maybe move in my career? What are the pain points, but also opportunities, recruitment or otherwise? It's a very interesting report.
Yeah. And I actually think that if you're mainly going into more the relocation recruitment, this is really interesting because startup cities bring a certain vibe. I was actually surprised to see Paris this high, but then I was listening to another podcast which was talking about how the French government totally revived the startup scene in France, which then accumulates in Paris, because and they made it really chef sacre that actually the prime minister or the president of France is actually involved in the entire venturing and getting startups off the ground, which is of course really interesting to understand. That for me, Paris was always, you know, a beautiful city but an old city. You know, it was becoming the new Vienna, which people in Europe know. It was great when the Habsburgers were there, but that was a few centuries ago. And right now it's just beautiful to visit as a tourist, but that's about it. You know? Yeah, it shows for a corporate perspective, it also tells me where are your competitors coming from? What are your labor market competitors coming from? Where will you see booms and busts? Where can you expect rises in rents? For example, if a city is climbing up, can you expect rises in people coming through the city? Also, relocation recruitment. How will you be dealing with that as a corporate as well?
Yeah, 100%. And I think what is also super important, what they put in here is their strategy part, is when you look at the criteria. So they looked at like size of knowledge pool, number of co-working spaces, access to world-leading startups, access to research funding and university-linked founders, and the quantity of accelerator programs. So I found this very interesting because in the top of my head, how would I find out what is the best environment for entrepreneurs to grow, right? Because if you invest in all of this, this is something where you can actually, you know, drive this a little bit and support this further. So this is also really, really interesting.
All right. And on that note, I would like to thank you both for another great monthly wrap-up. Now, there's a lot of events going on. The two of you told me you weren't going to be at Unleash in Paris. Unfortunately, I am. And after that, weirdly enough, I'm going to Bogota and Dubai. What events do you guys have scheduled for the next couple of months?
I have nothing. I have no event scheduled. I'm trying to build one. So I'll tell you more next wrap up. But I'll probably see you in Amsterdam Bus within a month. I'll be there for some projects.
I will. Then we will be taping this live.
Yeah, maybe.
So cool. I will talk in Zukunft Personal. You maybe heard of this. It's in Cologne, about skill-based hiring. Whoa. And then I think there were some other community events as well. I think 4th of September, there's a big HR community event where literally everyone, talent and HR, are meeting. So hope the weather will play out nicely. Yeah, I think there are some podcasts coming up as well, I hear. So yeah, quite busy, but I also try to avoid to stay a little bit low these days because I felt like I've done so much.
Well, and then just to my last thing, which I just want to, I'm very proud of. I've been asked to give a guest lecture for an IO psychology department at a university. So not even having a master title, not being an IO psychologist, being asked by a professor of IO psychology to talk to his students because he likes what I have to say on podcasts like this, was for me kind of an ego boost, to be honest.
Congrats.
Yes.
And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for listening, and we'll be back next month.